Welcome to the special Best of Counterspin, a look back at some of the most important stories of the past year. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. With a longer-than-usual election season and a meltdown in the financial markets, ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was certainly no shortage of news to explain and media messages to unspin. We can't cover it all in one half-hour program, of course, but we can bring together some of the notable critics, activists, and journalists that joined Counterspin in 2008 to talk about the way the corporate media covered, or in some cases ignored, the big stories of the year. So let's get to it on this special Best of Counterspin.
Of course, the biggest story of the year for the media was the presidential election. The longer-than-usual campaign season was, by everyone's account, historic on any number of levels. That's not to say, of course, that the media's coverage of the election was historically informative. Indeed, the corporate media's presentation was not without its usual detours and distractions. Anyone remember Joe the Plumber? One prime example of such distractions, Reverend Jeremiah Wright's appearance on the campaign radar. Barack Obama's Trinity Church pastor became a fixture on television, as well as a lightning rod. Bill Fletcher, the executive editor of the Black Commentator, shared his thoughts on Wright and the corporate media.
What really got the ire of the mainstream media was that he dared to question the myths that are associated with U.S. history, and particularly that he was willing to challenge the notion that the objectives of the U.S. with regard to foreign policy are noble. And he demonstrated that through various historical examples. In the United States, those that diverge from the established narrative, what is really a myth about the role of the U.S., U.S. foreign policy, et cetera, end up facing the wrath of the establishment. And that's really what was going on. I mean, for example, when Reverend Wright was talking about September 11th, he clearly was not in any way endorsing the terrorist attacks. But what he was saying was that the nature of U.S. foreign policy was such that there was what was called blowback. There was not anything particularly remarkable in him saying it, except that he was a black man criticizing U.S. foreign policy.
Fletcher added that Wright's presence on the national scene served a political purpose for opponents of Barack Obama.
His opponents essentially wanted to red-bait him. And they did that by saying, see, this is the guy's pastor. These are really his secret views. And therefore, he needs to be isolated. So really, it was the equivalent of red baiting. And insofar as anyone participated in that, it was absolutely criminal. Because, among other things, it was disingenuous, but it stops the ability for us to have real discussion about the issues and about history.
After the dust had settled in the Democratic primaries, Barack Obama and John McCain met in three televised debates. But the event moderated by PBS host Jim Lehrer on September 26th left many observers feeling that an opportunity to hear a real debate had been squandered. The session was supposed to focus on foreign policy broadly, but Lehrer dwelled almost exclusively on wars already underway, Iraq, Afghanistan, and potential wars of the future, Iran. Frequent Counterspin guest Phyllis Bennis, the director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project, joined the show to share her thoughts on that debate.
Well, I think it showed the degree to which there is not nearly the difference between the two candidates that I think most people think there is on specifically international issues. It, as you say, left out crucial questions, but it did reflect the reality of where political discourse is in this country in elite circles of both parties about how to think about the world, and that is the privileging of military involvement over diplomacy, the privileging of the Pentagon over the State Department in how political affairs in the rest of the world get dealt with. So in a sense, the problems with the questions that Jim Lehrer raised were very much a reflection of the problems of U.S. foreign policy today.
We also asked Bennis to imagine what questions she might ask if she were moderating such a presidential debate.
I think I would, if I had only one question in different language for each of them, but essentially the same question would be some version of, while you believe that these wars of choice that the U.S. has chosen in recent years are making us safer, people around the world not only believe but are acting on the belief that these wars are evidence not of a search for safety but of a search for domination. Regardless of whether you agree with them or not, how do you imagine being able to change that perception if you're not prepared to end the wars?
2008, of course, saw the emergence of Sarah Palin as the Republican vice presidential nominee and as an instant media phenomenon. Palin was the subject of intense coverage and, in keeping with a certain right-wing tradition, was held up as a victim of a supposedly hostile media. Extra editor Jim Narikas joined us to talk about this familiar tactic.
Well, I think that these charges have a great deal of use for the Republican Party. This is one of their standard tools, is to run against the elitist media. It helps you by informing your supporters that they can ignore any negative information that may arise. And it does tend to cover up the fact that they're actually getting a great deal of very positive free coverage from the mainstream media, which has completely gone out of their way to convey the GOP line that Sarah Palin is a moose-shooting mom who is bringing a fresh face to Washington, D.C.
We also discussed the reticence on the part of the media to do simple fact-checking, or, to put it more bluntly, to call out politicians who lie.
The media have a lot of trouble dealing with political lying. There is this sense that the word lie is something that you can't say. It's a kind of a taboo word. And so you end up with these various circumlocutions to avoid calling lies what they are. And it's thought that if you are criticizing one side for dishonesty, you have to criticize the other side for dishonesty at the same time, which completely neutralizes the criticism and makes it really there's no downside to lying if journalists are always going to find balancing lies by your opponent or make up balancing lies by your opponent if they have to, then there really is no downside to lying. And a politician who doesn't have some kind of principle against lying is always going to have an advantage over one who restrains himself from lying.
The meltdown in the U.S. financial industry and the widening economic crisis were, of course, a huge story in 2008 and will continue to be. For many people, the primary question is, why couldn't this have been prevented? And part of the reason has to be the narrow, business-dominated media debate, full of cheerleading for every uptick in the Dow, and where economists warning about the growing housing bubble, for example, couldn't get a word in edgewise. Counterspin spoke with one of those economists, Dean Baker, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, back in March. He noted that in media coverage of the government bailout of the financial industry, those who never saw it coming are nevertheless the experts on how to go forward.
It is an incredible indictment of the media that, you know, and it is very similar to Iraq, that, you know, there, you know, I was one of a small number. There were other economists, not a lot of us, who were warning about the housing bubble on the way up. And now that it's collapsed, to a large extent, we're still left out of the conversation. I remember I was listening to National Public Radio earlier this week, and they had a commentary by someone who was complaining about Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, the people were complaining that nothing was done about the housing bubble. Well, you know, it wasn't Monday morning quarterbacking. We were right there at the time. We were ignored, you know, in 03, 04, 05, 06, as the bubble was growing to ever more dangerous proportions. And the incredible part of the story is even now we're still being ignored. And you know, it's the same story as with Iraq. I mean, it seems to be that to qualify for an expert on many of these shows, you have to show that you were wrong.
We asked Baker about the effect of the absence of progressive economists from the media conversation.
The key thing is to realize that the economy has always been one in which the government actively intervenes, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, the government has an important role to play in the economy. But there's this conventional myth that on the one hand you have liberals, progressives who want the government to intervene, and then you have the conservatives who say no, 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 leave it to the market. And this is just, you know, it is totally in our face. The conservatives are running around like chickens with their heads cut off saying, get the government in, help us out, save us. The conservatives, the big Wall Street boys, want the government to come in and give them big handouts and save them because they got in over their heads. So this is a great chance to show, no, it's not about conservatives who don't want the government and liberals and progressives who want the government. It's just what you want the government to do. And the conservatives have been very effective at getting government to redistribute income upward to them and pretend that it was all just the market. And it wasn't. It was the government tilting the board. And in this case, it's not, you don't have to do any investigation. It's right in front of our eyes. They're standing there in full light of day, running to the Fed saying, give us money. And I think every liberal and progressive in the country should be pointing at that, go, yeah, we want to save the financial system. We don't want to save the richest people in the country. That's your problem. The government can intervene, though, to give people health care, to give them child care, to give them education. That's a proper role for government, ensuring that people could hang on to their vacation homes, their mansions on the Hamptons, their private jets. That's not the job for government.
Recently retired New York Times reporter and author David K. Johnston told Counterspin that part of the problem in coverage of the economic crisis was a kind of institutional misfocus on official sources.
Fundamentally, the problem here is the constant problem with Washington journalism, which is this idea that sources are what matter. And this is fueled by editors, you know, who say, well, the reason we have you in our Washington bureau is to talk to the official sources. Well, you'd probably get better coverage if you had a reporter sitting in your newsroom in Chicago or Rochester, where I live, or Los Angeles, reading the government's record and writing about all the things the government has to disclose. We've known there was a high risk of something like this happening. Not exactly what would happen, but some kind of serious collapse for 14 months. And one of the questions I haven't seen journalists asking is, well, all right, when you were put on notice 14 months ago in August of last year, what plans did Treasury and the other government agencies put in place in the event that the credit market seized up, that there was a huge collapse of asset values? And I'm fairly confident we will find out they didn't do anything.
Linking the financial meltdown to another ongoing disaster, Johnston thought the U.S. press corps was overdue for an increase in skepticism.
In the case of the Iraq scenario, remember that we now know, we didn't know then for sure, but we absolutely now know for sure that the Bush administration was aware that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Knowing that, recognizing that you have an administration that will lie through its teeth to pursue a policy that's cost thousands of Americans and probably tens of thousands of Iraqis their lives, why would you hesitate to think that they might not be telling you the whole truth and nothing but the truth about something dealing with money, particularly when, as President Bush famously said when he ran for office, that the people at the top were his base, the haves and the have-mores.
As the economic meltdown spread, there was, for a little while, some pretty critical talk in the press corps about corporate fat cats, if not enough about the structures that feed them, as it were. Institute for Policy Studies' Sarah Anderson has been working on the issue of excessive executive compensation for more than a decade. We asked her what it felt like to have the issue take center stage for a moment.
I've been working on this issue of executive pay for 15 years now, and I have bruises and scars from just getting beaten up, going on CNBC and Fox. I've been on the Neil Cavuto show and the Kudlow show on CNBC and just getting pummeled by people who, you know, do accuse me of being a class warrior. And all it is about greed, and I'm really just envious of these rich guys and so forth. And now it's really kind of bizarre to almost be feeling like a moderate here in Washington. If you listen to a lot of the people in the media and also in Congress right now, I sound pretty lukewarm.
Of course, the same press corps that now seemed to take on greedy CEOs had been instrumental in building up those CEOs' reputations as masterminds.
I was in a debate on CNBC a year ago, and they always put me up against about four people. And I pointed out that the CEO of Countrywide Financial had been one of the highest paid people in the country, I think number six in the year 2006. And And I thought that was an outrageous example of someone getting a huge payoff while his company was doing poorly. And I'm telling you, I had four people yelling at me saying, this is a guy who walks on water. He's done so much to build up that company, blah, blah, blah. I mean, now this guy, Angelo Mozzillo from Countrywide, is, you know, long gone from his company. He drove it into the ground. He's being investigated for insider trading and all of this. And so you see really how quickly these things change. I don't think I would go on there and get beaten up over criticizing Angelo Mozzillo today.
For much of the year, the story of the Iraq war was that it wasn't much of a media story. To the extent that Iraq intruded at all upon the 2008 presidential campaign, one major theme was the general improvement in the U.S. position there. As the mainstream media told it, the so-called troop surge in Iraq delivered lower levels of violence and a much greater chance that the war was turning yet another corner. Critics of the war and the troop surge, like Barack Obama, thus had something to answer for. But was the media hype about the success of the surge missing the point? Independent journalist Dar Jamail joined us in February to talk about that.
Well, one key jumping-off place that Mr. Bush and the media like to use is the dramatic decrease in the deaths of U.S. soldiers. Of course, this doesn't show anything about the reality on the ground, and especially about what Iraqis are having to endure. And that is really the one example that they can hold up, that there has been a quite dramatic decrease in the number of American soldiers dying. But I think this overlooks so much on the ground. I mean, just the broad brushstrokes of what's happened during the surge. I mean, we've had at roughly the same period of the surge, we've had a sevenfold increase in the amount of air power being used in Iraq. We have an ongoing massive number of Iraqis being killed and displaced from their homes. For example, as a direct result of the surge, the number of displaced Iraqis in Baghdad has quadrupled. One out of four people in Baghdad, a capital city of over 6 million people, has been displaced from their homes. The brunt of that has happened as a direct result of the surge. In addition to that, we have really a ghettoization of Baghdad, where neighborhoods have been completely segregated depending on whether you're Sunni or Shia. So this is one reason why, at least in Baghdad, the overall number of Iraqis being killed has dropped, which Mr. Bush likes to talk about. But the reason for this is it's really the end game of the sectarian cleansing from death squads that one could easily argue were initially set up and backed by the U.S. as policy. And so we have entire neighborhoods literally surrounded by concrete blocks and very, very strict control of movement in and out of those areas. And this is really what the situation is on the ground. And of course, that's really flies in the face of these claims of progress made by Bush and much of the media.
In April, the New York Times published a major investigation into the relationships between the Pentagon, various military contractors, and the ubiquitous former military officials who pontificate about military matters on the television networks. The Times report elicited an enormous response from peace activists who have long felt shut out of media debates about war, and from media watchers who demanded that the networks and the Pentagon explain this propaganda campaign. Fair associate Norman Solomon had explored militarism and the media in his book War Made Easy, which was recently made into a documentary film. And he joined us to commend the Times, but also to consider media culpability and the bigger picture.
There's a theme that runs through a lot of the contemporary semi-mea culpas or critiques in corporate media, that somehow the networks and other outlets were kind of bamboozled. And we show in the film War Made Easy how Eason Jordan, a top CNN official, went on the air of his own network and boasted soon after the invasion began that he'd visited the Pentagon, these are his words, several times with a list of possible military analysts. And he asked officials at the Defense Department whether it was a good list of military analysts to hire to speak on the air. These were, you know, retired generals and colonels and all the rest of it. And he said very bluntly how pleased he was. It was important, that's his word again, that he got a thumbs up from the Pentagon as to who CNN would actually put on the air to talk about the war.
As much as it may have told us, was the Times investigation too little too late? Solomon pondered the questions we'll likely be asking down the road.
I'm afraid we're often trapped in this sort of cyclical process that Mark Twain described as, it's easy to quit smoking. I've done it hundreds of times. It's easy for the news media to critique past performance well past when it's in real time, well past when it's making a difference in terms of policy, but the horizon keeps moving, and in terms of coverage, will have fertile ground for exposés 5 or 6 years from now, the ways that the networks and the New York Times failed to do forthright journalism in 2008.
In March, we saw one attempt to draw attention back to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The Winter Soldier hearings in Maryland brought together vets and active duty soldiers who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who tried to tell their firsthand accounts of the occupations of those two countries. FAIR founder Jeff Cohen shared his thoughts on these hearings and how they compared with the Winter Soldier hearings during the Vietnam War.
It was a near total lockout. It was quite an amazing thing. I've worked in television news. It had everything you would want in terms of a powerful visual statement. And the interesting thing this time, compared to 1971 in Detroit, I was at the first Winter Soldier hearings about Vietnam with Vietnam veterans. This one, so many of the soldiers had brought with them photographs and were presenting visually footage and photographs that they had taken on the ground. This was a near total lockout. There's no other way to explain what happened this last week besides calling it censorship. I saw no mention of this in the New York Times. I saw the Washington Post treat it primarily as a local story, and when it made it to the Section A, the pro-war vets, the minority that were had some sort of counter-protest, they were the featured people. Again, this was stunning, a stunning news story that mainstream media consumers did not know about. They could not learn about it.
Cohen did find a silver lining in coverage of the story, and that was the role of the independent press.
This event, while it was blacked out by the corporate media, it's so easy now to take people to it online because of the archives with video and radio, audio archives. We're in a much stronger position here to break a mainstream media embargo or blockade because of the power of independent media and the rise of the internet. It's a huge difference in a few decades, a massive difference.
Counterspin seeks out media critics and historians to share their perspectives on the state of media ownership and telecommunications policy, a nod to the reality that media problems do not exist in a vacuum, but are often the result of decisions made at the top. Who owns what? A new documentary called Disappearing Voices tracks the decline of black radio and recalls the historic significance of African-American disc jockeys and black-owned radio outlets. Counterspin was joined by Ayanna Jones, the executive producer of the film, to discuss that history.
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is to understand the impact that black jocks had on radio. They basically changed the face of radio as we know it today and really turned it into an art form that is unique to America. Radio was not done the way it is done today until the black jocks started it. And what is significant about black jocks in particular is that they bought a brand of personality and a connection to the culture and to the community, to the airwaves that made people feel like that they were a part of a movement. And that's what you don't have today. And a number of factors have contributed to that, including the watering down of radio, the depersonalization of it, conglomeration, and of course, the rendering of black radio unprofitable by a number of different factors, which are talked about in the film, including Arbitron, Madison Avenue, and the thing that it all stems from, racism.
Ayanna Jones talked about audience rating systems and advertising policies that have long undermined minority-owned media and the reality that decisions that affect programming and media democracy are not strictly business decisions.
The idea that people don't want to hear news, that they don't want to hear political content, that they don't want to hear independent music is ridiculous. If we can go by the proposed argument that this is what people want to listen to, you could then say this is what they listen to because it's all that is available. The majority of people, in fact, don't even listen to commercial radio if you actually do a poll. So the idea of people who are listening that this is what they want, they're just listening to what they get. My suggestion would be to level the playing field. Why don't you start playing some independent music? music. Start having some community voices that are well-known in the communities who are working in a political activism direction to uplift their communities. Let them get on the radio, and then let's see what people choose. Because really, in essence, what's going on is it's a form of censorship in terms of not allowing these other voices in, and that's directly related to conglomeration. But conglomeration is absolutely on purpose and has other goals and agendas other than just simply making money.
And finally, we noted in 2008 the passing of some legendary names in media activism and radio. Journalist and oral historian Studs Terkel died just a few weeks ago. Back in February, pioneering journalist and women's health advocate Barbara Seaman passed away. Seaman had been a guest on Counterspin and a contributor to Fares magazine Extra. Throughout her career, she fought the medical and journalistic establishment as she sought to strengthen women's voices in the public debate over health policy. She was perhaps most remembered for her reporting on the dangers of the birth control pill and more recently on the risks associated with hormone replacement therapy. Pursuing these stories put her at odds with much of the corporate media and, as one might suspect, cost her a few jobs along the way. Cynthia Pearson, the executive director of the National Women's Health Network, a group Seaman founded, joined Counterspin to recall that part of Barbara Seaman's legacy.
Barbara was, as she said towards the end of her life, proud to have been fired from several jobs because of the investigative and expose nature of her work. Some of her editors had the candor to even tell her how it was done. You know, large advertisers would come in, large corporate firms that had health products would come in and sit down and say, no, we're about to launch something really big. It's going to be big ads every month, several months in a row, and we're looking at you, but we're also looking at this other magazine. And right now it just seems like it's a friendlier climate over there. But, you know, if we felt like it would be a friendly climate at your magazine, we'd definitely put our ads with you, and then Barbara would get fired. And that happened repeatedly. Sometimes the editors didn't have quite as much candor and honesty to tell her exactly that's what was going on, but the pattern became very obvious. And Barbara was passionate. There's no denying that. She wanted change. She believed she saw what needed to improve to be more respectful of women and to improve the products and the services. But she never strayed from the science. She was careful, and she was right.
Another reminder, if any were necessary, that being right can often put you at odds with the media establishment. Lucky for us, that never stopped Barbara Seaman, Studs Terkel, or the scores of other journalists doing the same. That's it for this special Best of Counterspin. The show is brought to you by the media watchdog group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR's print magazine, Extra, has gone monthly. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Or go to FAIR's website, www.fair.org. While you're there, you can also listen to past episodes of Counterspin or sign up for the Counterspin podcast. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.